to do. Okay.
As usual, a few brief announcements before we start. Homework 2 is due in an hour and 15 minutes. People who aren't here are either mad at me for making a hard homework or still doing it. But homework 3, I figured we should talk about that a little bit. You may notice that 13.9 is no longer part of the homework. It's because it wasn't a fair question. But if you want to do a Taylor series expansion, you can. Laughter, that tells me exactly what I need to know. The other half of the problem, other half of the homework set besides the book problems, is the first Python problem for the class. Most of the questions that are asked here will make more sense after Wednesday. Ray will be leading the class on Wednesday when we talk about HR diagrams and stellar parameters and stuff, so be nice to Ray. He has done nothing to earn your scorn like I have when giving you hard homework. He just grades them, so you should be extra nice to him. So I think most of the stuff in this Python question is just sort of straightforward, just making graphs. There's this thing here with part 1, 2, and 3. There's stuff in the Python module that Carrie posted on Discord and Canvas that has, I think, everything you need to know to do that. Stuff is in that Python module that she posted, so hopefully there's some good stuff in there. And then last thing I just wanted to say is that reminder that the midterm is not too far off now. And also this homework is due on October 11th at midnight now instead of 11:59 p.m. instead of on next Wednesday at the end of class. So you have extra time to do all the Python stuff. Just why not? Anyway, the midterm will be the day on the Wednesday after this homework is due, which is October 13th. In class, don't forget that you have a sheet of paper, both sides, with whatever you want on it. Equations, constants, pictures of your cat, I don't know. But like I said, at the beginning of the exam will be mostly like not necessarily math, but like concepts and explaining things. So, and I guess what the last thing was that the rooftop telescope is now open for use. So if you're interested in getting trained to use that on your own, let me know. Send me an email. We will train you up at some point, but we are going to do a class night, hopefully the week of the midterm, as a reward for finishing the midterm. But weather is always an issue, so stay tuned. That week is a good week for the moon, so that's why it's that week. Okay, any questions about any of the administrative stuff we've talked about so far? No, cool. All right, so back to, ouch, sorry. Back to what we were talking about on Wednesday. We left off talking about brightness. So we were talking about how basically when you have a star, you can measure its luminosity, which is its total energy output, right? And then you observe a star from some distance d. So that total energy output of the star is spread out over a sphere of radius d. D meaning distance, not diameter, so careful about that one. So we just did a quick example with the sun, where the luminosity of the sun is 3.8 times 10 to the 26 watts, and the distance between us on Earth and the sun is 1.5 times 10 to the 11 meters, and so that gives you a brightness of 1,344 watts per square meter. Which we said was the equivalent of 1,300 watt light bulbs. David?
And sorry, just for clarification, is that on the surface of the sun or the surface of the Earth? The
surface of the Earth.
Okay, cool.
If you worked back, right, you could take the radius of the sun, and measure what a square meter of luminosity was on the sun, but you need to know how big it was. And so this is a good point to drop something else in, which is that if we, how we defined luminosity previously in the class when we talked about black body radiation was to say that luminosity is the surface area of the object times sigma T to the fourth, where T is the temperature in Kelvin, right? We're gonna go ahead in this class and assume that stars are spheres, right? Even though usually they're not perfect spheres, but it's close enough, right? So we can say that the luminosity of a star is 4 pi r squared sigma T to the fourth, where r is the radius of the star. You may ask, how do you know the radius of a star? That's a good question. Usually you have to work backwards to figure it out, but Ray will talk a bit more about that on Wednesday, hopefully. And sort of piece together, based on the type of star that it is, a sort of a general estimate. So that's just something to remember. So I wanted to spend sort of the first half of class today talking about, and we'll see how long it takes, but to talking about magnitudes finally, because it's time to talk about magnitudes. We have to do it. So you may have some idea already of how this system might work intuitively. It seems counterintuitive in some senses, but really it kind of makes sense when you think about it. So basically, the backstory here is that the ancient Greeks were interested in more sort of, taxonomy of sort of putting together like a description of how stars look in a not an English major, sort of a hierarchical way. If you sort of structure, can we group stars into various groups based on their properties. And the main property of stars that you can observe with your eye, with the, you know, the technology that the ancient Greeks had, was just the eye, basically. Was just how bright it was, how bright it appears to be in the sky, right? You can do that now too, right? You can go out, you can look, and you can see that stars are different brightnesses to your eye. And so what the ancient Greeks did, in particular, a guy named Hipparchus, was to categorize the stars into six groups. And what he did was he ranked them from brightest to faintest into these six groups. So the brightest stars were the first magnitude stars, right? They are the winners of the race of brightness. They're first place. And the faintest stars you could see are the losers, I guess, but not really losers. They're the faintest stars, so they're in the sixth magnitude. So that was the way the system worked for a long time. You just sort of ranked them based on what the appearance to your eye they look like, sort of relative. This one's fainter than this one, is fainter than this one, and so they split up into their categories. Later on, when technology got better and we could actually do more direct measurements of brightness and learn more about how the human eye works, we found out that the human eye's response to light is logarithmic. Don't ask me how we know that. I have no idea. But it's logarithmic, which means that we don't see linearly, right? If you turn the brightness of something up, we're not going to see that brightness appear in our eyes to turn up. You know, if you double the brightness, double the current going into a bulb, right? You may double the amount of luminosity coming out of it, but our eye's response to it does not follow linearly. That's what that means. So what really that means is that instead of being able to measure with our eyes a difference in how much brighter an object gets, we can measure a ratio on how much brighter it gets. So when we went back and we measured the brightnesses of the stars, we found that the brightness ratio between the brightest star in the first magnitude and the faintest star that you could see with your eyes in the sixth magnitude was 100 times in brightness. So what that means is that a difference of 5 magnitudes, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 6 minus 1 is 5, right? A difference in 5 magnitudes corresponds to a ratio of 100 in brightness. So a first magnitude star is 100 times brighter than a sixth magnitude star. A sixth magnitude star is 100 times fainter than a first magnitude star. Steve.
Is that where M1 and M2
come from? M1 and M2? Oh, there is a kind of star called an M star, but that it's something entirely different. Ray will talk about that on Wednesday. So if you want to write that down mathematically, right, you can do it. So we can say, okay, we have two brightnesses we can measure, B1 and B2. And we can write out an equation to quantify this idea of a difference of 100, or a ratio of 100 is due to a difference of 5 magnitudes. So you have 100 here as the root of an exponent. And then in the exponent, you have magnitude of star 2 minus magnitude of star 1 divided by 5. So if you plug in, I have a difference of 5 magnitudes, right? If M2 minus M1 is equal to 5. You have 100 to the 5 divided by 5, which is 100 to the 1, which is just 100, right? If you have a difference of 10 magnitudes in this part here, you have 100 to the 10 divided by 5, which is 100 squared, which is 10,000. Or if you only have a difference of 1 magnitude, right, you can, you know, follow the whole relationship that way. So 100 to the 1 divided by 5 is 100 to the 0.2, which is equal to 2.512. Right? So a difference of 1 magnitude is a ratio of 2.512 in brightness. So if you go down magnitude by magnitude, right? So first, or a sixth magnitude star, a fifth magnitude star is 2.5 times as bright as a sixth magnitude star. A fourth magnitude star is 2.5 times as bright as a fifth, and so on and so forth, right? Okay. And then just reminders of what brightness and luminosity are there. Okay, so we can simplify this down a bit more. If we want to, if we just know, for example, that's sort of a basic integer way of doing it, but measuring an actual magnitude, you don't necessarily get an integer number in the modern system, right? You can measure an actual, you know, 5.672 is your magnitude. So if you continue along with the derivation here, right, you can change the 100 in the root of that exponent to a 10 squared. Right, 100 is just 10 times 10. So you can put a little 2 there and make it 10 squared instead of 100. And then you can simplify stuff up here in the exponent. 2 divided by 5 is 0.4, so you still have your difference of magnitudes here, which is equal to 10 to the 1 over 2.5. And then if you take the log base 10 of both sides, to figure out, just get the magnitudes by themselves instead of being inside of an exponent. A quick note, I'm writing log 10 here
just to be clear, for our first time talking about logs in this class, but usually from now on, if I say log, I mean log base 10. And if I mean natural log, I'll say natural log or ln or whatever, right? That's the typical astronomy convention, is log means log base 10 and natural log is ln. That may not be what the buttons are on your calculator, right? Sometimes log means natural log on a calculator, maybe not yours. In Python, log, the numpy.log function is natural log, annoyingly. So you need to do, in NumPy, you need to say log 10 to get that to work correctly. We will notice immediately if you've done the wrong one. It's a common error. But hopefully by saying it out loud, that makes you think about it. Anyway, you take the log base 10 of both sides. So now you have m2 minus m1 divided by 2.5 here is equal to log base 10 of the ratio of the brightnesses. You can multiply both sides by 2.5 to move that over. And so, and then what we're doing here is we're flipping the top and the bottom in the division to put a negative sign out front. So basically what this is just saying, this is just a different version of a difference of 5 magnitudes is a factor of 100 in brightness. M2 minus M1, so it's a difference in magnitudes, is equal to negative 2.5 log 10 of B2 divided by B1, where B2 and B1 are brightnesses, or fluxes, or whatever you want to call that, right? How is this useful to us? This is, I guess, a good point for a discussion question, right? Why do we care about what the a difference of magnitudes, how what it corresponds to in terms of a brightness factor? Why is that relevant thing to know? Talk about it for a second. So why? What do we have any ideas for this one? David?
So once you get the light of the brightness, then you define the difference in the magnitude just using this equation.
Right. That is the idea.
Yeah.
But why? Nathaniel.
It could probably help you predict like properties of stars.
Yeah. Like what sort of properties? Size, age, with a few more steps in between, yeah, you can get there, yeah. But it's a good start, for sure. Anything else?
It's a convenient way to like kind of categorize and compare stars in the sky.
Yeah, I mean, we want to. One of the main things Ray will be talking about on Wednesday is called an HR diagram, which sort of is the periodic table of stars, and it's largely built on this idea. Yeah. What about distance? Is there a way that we could help figure out distances to stars this way, Steve?
Yeah, because you got a magnitude, and you have another relative magnitude of another star, so then you can just do math, and you get another brightness.
Yeah.
And that the equation for brightness has that luminosity over distance, effectively. And then if you have brightness, you have one or two variables left, so there's probably some nonsense you can do. But having a magnitude means you can get to the distance of that other star pretty easily.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. It's mostly nonsense, but, let's talk about it. So this is an idea called spectroscopic parallax. So this is just up here at the top. It's just a quick recap of the basic idea, right, of the magnitude system, right, that it's a logarithmic scale. A difference in magnitude of 5 is 100 to 1 in brightness. A difference in magnitude of 1 is 2.512 to 1. And we're talking about flux ratios, not differences here, right? But to sort of move along a little bit further, we need to introduce a concept of apparent magnitude. So apparent magnitude is what we observe from here on Earth, right? So when we say apparent, it's like, what does it look like, right? And just this other concept here, right, is that smaller numbers are brighter. That comes from that basic original idea of ranking things from 1 to 6, right, where 6 is the faintest and 1 is the brightest. We're going to carry that through into the modern system and say that more negative values, smaller values, more negative values are brighter, right? So just as a sort of brief overview of what that might look like, right? The sun is the brightest thing in the sky, right? Hopefully that is an intuitive thing to say. The sun is the brightest thing in the sky, right? You don't want to look at it. It's too bright to look at. And you should not look at it. Don't do it. The sun's apparent magnitude is -26.8. So how does that fit into our first through sixth system, right? It's way off the scale. So the sun is 27 magnitudes brighter than the brightest star the Greeks measured in their system. So that's 10 to the 27 divided by 5 factor in brightness, which is a huge, huge brightness factor, right? The brightest star in the sky, Sirius, is magnitude -1.46. That's the brightest star in the sky. It's we're bothering Tiffany. that's in the winter sky. You'll be able to see it coming up soon. The star Vega, which is a summer triangle star, it's sort of a pale white color. That has a magnitude of 0.00000000. Why do I say it like that? David?
To show that it's that precise.
So that's that precise, that's true. Yeah. Garrett? Exactly. We've defined Vega, the star Vega, to be the zero point of this system. So that if you ask someone what the magnitude of Vega is, it's zero in any way of measuring magnitude, of which there are many, which we will talk about later. the naked eye limit, right? The faintest thing that you can see with your naked eye is plus six magnitudes. So that's right, the sixth group of stars, the ranked sixth brightest stars. Those were the faintest ones the Greeks could see. So it's right there at six. And then sort of I've written here theoretical limit, but things can be infinitely faint. But between a combination of the capabilities that modern telescopes have and stuff like how bright the sky is, because the sky has brightness to itself, we're not gonna dive into that quite yet, but the faintest thing that you could probably observe is about a magnitude of plus 29 or so. So that's way down there, right? So you're spanning about 60 magnitudes between the brightest thing in the sky and the faintest thing you could possibly observe with a giant, like 10 plus meter telescope. Okay, so apparent magnitude is what you see, right? That's the easy measurement to make. You just go out, you look, you measure. This one is brighter than this one, and I know this one is plus 5, so this one must be plus 4, for example, is a way to do it by eye, or you can actually get out an instrument, take a picture, measure, count how many photons you have. Okay. There's another concept to introduce here now, which is something called absolute magnitude. So what might we mean by absolute magnitude? If apparent magnitude is what we see, what we observe from here on Earth, what do we mean by absolute?
Describe the magnitude in a way that's not dependent on the observer's location.
Exactly. Right, so it's going to be a standard measurement that we can directly compare two different stars against, right? It's a lot more like an intrinsic property of the star than the apparent magnitude, which will depend on how far away you are, which will depend on how you're looking at it. Joanne?
Can you explain like the difference between that and brightness and like luminosity more?
Yeah, so so let's start with luminosity, right? Luminosity is the fundamental intrinsic property of the star, right? So luminosity is how much energy does that star output total? Count up all the photons, measure their energies, and add it all up, and that's what you have, just the total energy output of the star. Doesn't matter where you're looking from, it doesn't matter how you're looking at it, it's just total energy. Brightness is taking that luminosity and painting it over a sphere of some radius of the distance away that you're observing it from. Right, so if I had a total energy output of 5 watts, right, someone that was 1 meter away from me would see 5 watts per square meter, roughly, right? Someone that was 2 meters away from me would see 5 divided by 4 watts per square meter, because it's distance squared, right? So that's the inverse square law. The further away you get, the fainter something looks. Even though its intrinsic energy output remains the same, you observe something fainter the further away you get. That's apparent magnitude. Brightness and apparent magnitude are the same.
Okay.
Right? Then absolute magnitude is what the brightness will appear to be from a fixed distance. So here I've written out, right, apparent magnitude little lowercase m is luminosity divided by 4 pi d squared. Absolute magnitude, capital M, and hopefully my handwriting will be clear enough to distinguish between the two, right, little m and big M. Absolute magnitude is luminosity divided by 4 pi 10 parsecs squared. So absolute magnitude, we're going to choose arbitrarily to be the magnitude that you would observe from a distance of 10 parsecs away.
So apparent magnitude and brightness are the same thing?
Apparent magnitude and brightness aren't identical, but they're referring to sort of the same idea. That's the observed
quantity that you're looking at, right? So brightness is the different units, right? Brightness is watts per square meter. Magnitudes don't have units, right? They're just numbers. But apparent magnitude would be the observed magnitude. And then absolute magnitude, you can sort of map to luminosity, right? Because it will be always observed from the same distance, 10 parsecs. You can sort of say two stars have the same luminosity, will have the same absolute magnitude. But a brighter star will have a more luminous star, is maybe a better way to say that. A more luminous star will have a more negative absolute magnitude. Garrett?
By the distance of 10 parsecs from a star, the apparent and absolute are the same always.
Correct. Right. So that's a good point, right? At a distance of 10 parsecs, if you are exactly 10 parsecs away from a star, you will be measuring its absolute magnitude as your apparent magnitude. That's the idea. And we'll sort of derive that idea here in a second. Right, apparent magnitude maps to brightness, absolute magnitude maps to luminosity. It's just in different units. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so what you'll notice here, right? Actually, hang on. Why 10 parsecs? It's sort of an arbitrary number, but why?
Does that happen to be the distance Vega is from us?
Not quite. I don't remember exactly how far away Vega is. Do you, Ray?
It's like 25.
25 parsecs? Steve?
Does that have to do with
that helps, but I don't think it's the exact direct reason. It really is basically just arbitrary. When the system was defined, what?
Sorry, I was just reinforcing it. I said it was good attempts.
Oh, yeah. It really is just arbitrary, right? When the system was first sort of defined this way, 10 parsecs was about how far away we could accurately measure distances with parallax. And so if you can't know the distance to anything further away than 10 parsecs accurately, you can't base a system on it. So we ended up with 10 parsecs. Yeah. There aren't that many stars within 10 parsecs of the sun, right? So that's a really small sample size. It's like 100 or less. There's a cool animation we can show on Wednesday. Maybe you have it, maybe you don't, but we'll make sure you have it. Okay, so how does this help us find distance then? Right? If all we can measure is the apparent magnitude and we have to know something about the star to figure out how far away it is, to figure out its absolute magnitude, right? You're assuming a distance of 10 parsecs, but you still need to know what its luminosity is. How is that going to help us find distance? How would we even find distance if we did know? Let's go through it, right? So these are just two magnitudes, right? You have an apparent and an absolute magnitude, which means that a difference of the two is going to be equal to some brightness ratio, right? So you can set it up where you take that brightness ratio and put it inside your log here. So you have measured observed brightness divided by the brightness at 10 parsecs. So L over 4 pi d squared divided by L over 4 pi 10 parsecs squared. Now you can start canceling stuff, which is always fun to do, right? Look at that, the luminosities cancel each other out. Now you don't need to know what the luminosity of the star is anymore. No need to worry about it. It cancels out, because you're looking at the same star here, right? You're just assuming for one observer it's at 10 parsecs. 4 pi's go away.
So you're left with little m, right, apparent minus absolute is equal to negative 2.5 log 10 squared divided by d squared. Remember that if you have the log of a ratio, that's the same thing as saying log x minus log y, right? That's one of your log tricks. So you can split that out into negative 2.5 log 10 squared plus, because you have a minus, should have a minus sign there, but you have a negative number from it being 1 over, plus 2.5 log d squared. And then you can turn log 10 squared into 2 times log of 1, which is this thing here, right? Log of, if you have an exponent inside a log, you can move it out front and multiply by that number, right? Another log trick. So what you end up with is little m minus big M, apparent minus absolute, is negative 5 log 10, which is just 1, right? Because log base 10 of 10 is 1, plus 5 times the log of the distance. And if you rearrange that a little bit more, you get apparent minus absolute is equal to 5 times the log of the distance minus 5, which is something called the distance modulus. And where it's important to note that the distance in here is in parsecs, right? So the way you would get it from a parallax measurement. We will just, remember, we'll use parsecs as our unit of distance in this class. That's the most straightforward unit to use, even though you just learned about it last week. So if you can figure out what the absolute magnitude of a star is, you can figure out how far away it is, pretty straightforwardly. How would you find out what the absolute magnitude of a star is? It's like sort of the same thing as measuring luminosity, right? But you don't need to measure the, you know, the unit, what the number is in watts. You can just figure out what its magnitude is. How might you do that? That's actually kind of more of a rhetorical question, because that's the hard part about astronomy, is figuring out what things are, what the brightness, what the luminosity of something is supposed to be. So there's lots of different ways to do it, but we will talk about some of them in this class. The most basic fundamental way is looking at something like the HR diagram, which Ray will talk about on Wednesday. So if you know an apparent magnitude, an absolute magnitude, or a distance, you can figure out the third quantity that you don't know, right? Just as an aside, the absolute magnitude of the sun is 4.76. So if you were 10 parsecs away from the sun, it would still be visible to the naked eye, right? It's roughly magnitude 5, so you can still see it, but it's not particularly bright. Yeah. There is no unit. That's one of the things about logs, is that it erases units, right? Often what you would see is it written as sort of log of d divided by 1 parsec or something, to sort of make it clear that you're canceling units out inside of there, but I find that tedious to write, so I don't. But magnitudes don't have units. It's sort of, I think, sort of meant to be that way, and sort of a you don't need to worry about what unit you're thinking about type reason. You can just compare the numbers and know intuitively that this one's brighter than the other one, and not have to be like, oh, am I in watts or ergs per second or whatever, right? Okay, so one of the things on the homework is adding magnitudes. Basically, two of the questions ask you to, if you have two stars that you know are certain magnitudes,
and you observe them together, like if you can't resolve the two of them apart with your telescope, how bright will it appear, basically? So
the reason that that's a homework problem is because it's not just as simple as saying I have a magnitude 5 star and a magnitude 3 star, so their total magnitude is 8, right? Because that doesn't make sense, right? If smaller numbers are brighter, how did you get a bigger, more positive number if you added two things together? How did you get fainter if you added two stars together, right? So how do you add magnitudes together? Basically, the idea is that you have to convert to luminosity first, go backwards, and then add the luminosity and then convert back. So if you wanted to do M1 plus M2, right, you can't just take M1 and add M2 to it. You have to say M1 is equal to negative 2.5 log of luminosity divided by 4 pi d squared. M2 is equal to negative 2.5 log luminosity 2 divided by 4 pi d squared d1 and d2. I think in the problem in the book that this is asking you about, you're going to assume that the distances are the same, which makes this easier, right? It doesn't matter what the distance is. You can just figure out, or it may tell you the distance. This is the sort of the basic first step of how you would do that, right? You have to rearrange to get luminosity by itself and go from there. But that's the basic idea behind adding magnitudes. Yeah, Mark.
If the distances weren't the same, would you just average them?
If the distances weren't the same, you'd want to figure out what they are first, because then luminosity isn't necessarily what you think it is based on the distance. Yeah. Just best to be safe.
Just to reiterate, magnitudes only subtract. They don't add, they don't multiply, they don't divide, they don't exponent each other. Don't do anything with magnitudes if it isn't subtraction.
And it, when you subtract them, it only tells you about a brightness ratio.
Yes.
It doesn't tell you that, you know, right? M1 minus M2 doesn't tell you the total brightness of the system, the total magnitude of the system. It only tells you what the ratio in the two magnitudes is in brightness. Okay. That was a lot about magnitudes, which is an esoteric topic, but I hope this will become more intuitive as we use them more. We'll sort of switch back and forth between magnitude and luminosity as ways of talking about things. When we talk about theoretical, we'll use luminosity. When we talk about observed things, we'll use magnitude. I hope that doesn't get too confusing, but usually it will make sense. And we'll try to show things that map the two values so you can sort of understand how they map onto each other. But magnitudes are a widely used way of expressing brightnesses in astronomy, and so I think it's important that you know about them. Okay, for the last half hour, I want to talk about, finally, the sun, right? Finally, some actual hands-on theoretical astronomy. That sentence makes no sense. Can't do hands-on theoretical astronomy. It's impossible. So I'm just up here babbling. The sun. Okay. Let's start with a nice discussion question. What do you know about the sun? What do you already know about it, besides that you shouldn't look at it? So talk amongst yourselves for a minute. What do you know about the sun?
Thank you.
They might try to make it look accurate, but there's a lot that goes into that. Because your eye is not perfect.
And like the infrared or ultraviolet images are always like fun colors, right?
Right. Because you can't like, see them, you can't see that wavelength of light, right? So you have to map it onto something.
Yeah.
So they give it a weird color so that your brain says this is invisible light. Okay. What did we come up with? What do we know about the sun? David.
It's about 93 million miles away.
That's right. We should just play the song, right? And then just call it a day. 93 million miles away. For the metrically minded of you, that's 150 million kilometers. What else?
It's a giant nuclear fusion reactor.
Sure is. Yeah, so the sun is powered by nuclear fusion. We won't talk more about that today. We'll sort of use the sun as the context for talking about processes in stars as we spend the next few weeks on talking about stars. So we'll get to that in a few weeks, I think. But yes, the basic idea is that the sun is powered by nuclear fusion. Of what, do you remember? Of what?
Primarily hydrogen and helium.
Yeah, hydrogen into helium is the main thing that the sun does to power itself. What else? Go ahead.
Isn't it like a pretty like medium-ish size star?
Yeah. The sun is totally average as stars go. It's just a normal star, right? It's got sort of a medium mass, a medium size, a medium temperature. Not too hot, not too cold type thing. Garrett.
Yeah, it's like multiple layers of different temperatures.
Uh-huh. we'll call that like an onion structure. We will talk about that today. Much like ogres.
Stars are. I just watched that with my kid last week. It was great.
It holds up.
What else? Yes, it has a magnetic field, which turns out to be really important for the sun. And in a lot of ways is the reason that we don't immediately die anytime the sun does something different, which is nice. Magnetic fields in general are very useful to our survival. What else?
It'll sometimes inject some of its matter and radiation into that sort of thing.
I'm going to say eject matter because sort of the, I guess, yeah, the point, sort of the point of the sun is that it's constantly ejecting radiation. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. So, but yeah, it does burp and cough and stuff. Anything else? Steve?
It's rotating around our galaxy.
It's rotating around.
Traveling.
Yeah. It's orbiting around our galaxy. That's true. We will leave the galactic part of it at that until next semester if you take 222. So it's not the right class for that. Foggy today. Thanks. Anything else? Nathaniel?
Stars rotate too.
Stars, yeah, they also spin. Spin, rotate, whatever you want to call it. Anybody know anything about the properties of the sun? Sort of the basic measurements at all? No? Okay. Let's start with the temperature, right? Kelvin is the quote unquote surface temperature. When we say surface, we mean something very specific about the sun, which we'll define in a few minutes. But this is basically the number that you would use for computing luminosity or luminosity, basically, is the one thing that you would compute with that. Or like black body curve or whatever, you use that, what we call the effective temperature. With a temperature of, an effective temperature of 5,780 Kelvin, that gives the sun sort of a pale yellow color. To the human eye, anyway. So if you could go out and look at the sun, which you should not do, it would look pale yellow if you were much further away and it weren't so bright. You'd probably want like a magnitude of like roughly the moon, I think like -12 before it would be safe to look at. So we're talking like outer solar system probably. So maybe in your lifetime you will be able to look at the sun and not go blind right away. Pale yellow color. Radius. So actual size, right? Remember, it's 150 million kilometers away, so 10 to the 8 kilometers. Its radius is about 6.96 times 10 to the 5 kilometers. However, unless you specifically need to know how big it is in kilometers or meters or whatever, I would vastly prefer you use the unit 1 solar radius, which is an astronomical unit, meaning one size of the sun. That's not where the S should go in that word. one solar radius is a much easier number to remember than 7 × 10⁵ kilometers. Steve?
Is that the R subscript little plus?
It's actually a little circle with a dot in it, like so. So that little circle with the dot in it means sun. So you'll see that in the book and other places. That is difficult for my giant hands to write on this thing, so I will usually write out the word sun if I mean radius of the sun or something. So the radius of the sun, I would prefer you think of it as one solar radius, because we're going to use the sun as our benchmark for every other star in the galaxy and in the universe. So that's a good one to know, right? So what about the luminosity? We already know that one. 3.8 × 10⁶ watts. Or if you prefer, it's 3.8 × 10⁻³ ergs per second. But I would prefer that in this class you would refer to it as one solar luminosity. Because, you know, what's easier to remember than one? So that would be L dot. And there's one more fundamental property to talk about, and that's the mass. So you can see why this is hard for me to draw, right? I can't quite. 1.99 × 10⁷ kilograms. Or say it with me, one solar mass. So that's big. 2 × 10⁰ kilograms is a lot of kilograms, right? The sun is the most massive object in the solar system by a long shot. Hopefully that's an obvious statement, but nevertheless it is. So those are your basic numerical properties of the sun, right? Radius, luminosity, temperature, mass. Those are the things that you can sort of easily measure just by sort of looking at it. It's easy to measure the solar radius, right? You know how far away it is. You can actually figure out the angular size and turn it into a physical size, since you can resolve the sun. There are other things about it, though, that are slightly more difficult to measure and weren't done until we had to develop the technology to do it. One of those is chemical composition. How do we measure the chemical composition of something out in space? Joanne?
The spectrum.
Right. We can look at its spectrum. We've already looked at the spectrum of the sun in this class. It looks like this, right? Each one of these absorption lines is from a particular transition in an element, an electron moving up from a lower energy state to a higher energy state as a photon hits it. There are a few that we mentioned in class when we talked about it. This is H alpha, the Balmer alpha line. And then there are two other, I think this one and that one, or that one. I can't remember which one are the other Balmer lines. This pair here in the yellow is sodium. There's a bunch of helium lines in here, a bunch of iron lines. Any element you can think of in the periodic table. Well, not any element, I guess. You don't really see fluorine very well in the sun, do you? Anyway, if you can think of an element it's probably there in some form or another. So if we unpack all those lines and figure out what elements they belong to, look at the relative strength of them, think about properties of the star, we can figure out what the relative chemical composition of the surface of the sun is, right? Remember, we're observing the outer layer of the onion, not anything inside. So this is all based on what the top layer of the sun looks like. The same way that if someone looked at you, they wouldn't be able to see what's inside of you. They only see the outside layer, right? That's a good analogy. I'm going to use that. So based on this spectrum of the sun, we were able to determine that by mass, the sun is composed of 70% hydrogen, 28% helium, and 2% everything else. When I mean everything else, what sort of elements am I talking about? Other than the literal interpretation of all of them, but the main ones that we see in the sun are things like oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, iron, magnesium, sort of the basic things that you find in the atmosphere or in water, right? People, rocks are mostly iron, magnesium, silicon is in there. David? Yeah, heavy metals, anything that's not hydrogen, helium, or lithium in very small proportions is made in a star, or the death of a star, or the collision of two stars, or some stellar process you need to make, some fusion process to make anything heavier than lithium, pretty much. Steve?
When we're writing this, should we be writing hydrogen as H? Is that how it appears, or is it
When I mean, it's in actually in lots of different forms in the star. But I don't think there's any molecular hydrogen in the sun. It's too hot.
Okay.
So it's all going to be either atomic or H minus or H plus.
Right.
Or
okay.
When I say H plus, that's obviously just a proton, right? So really, it's just a ball of protons most of the time. But unless I need to be specific about what type I'm talking about, just assume atomic.
Okay.
With a like neutral with an electron in it. I'm going to mention this now. Another annoying thing astronomers do is assume that everything heavier than hydrogen and helium is a metal. So like oxygen, my favorite metal. That's just pure laziness, basically, but it makes sense when you think about the pressures and temperatures that are involved. Things aren't necessarily in the gaseous state, so what do you call something that's so high density that it's... Anyway, we'll come back to that idea. By number, these things are a bit different, right? So, right, hydrogen is a light element versus things like oxygen and iron, those are heavier elements. So if we think about by number of atoms instead of mass, it would be 92.1% hydrogen, 78% helium. No, sorry. I can't put, no. 28%. No. What? Why does it say 78%? 7.8%. There we go. 7.8% helium and 0.1% metals. So if you want to think about the solar system as a whole having roughly the same proportions of elements in it, that all form from the same material. So you know, the planets, the people, all that stuff is wrapped up in 0.1% of the stuff in the solar system. Any questions so far? There's sort of one other property we can sort of roughly measure, and that is the mean density of the sun, right? You can just measure its size and its mass pretty straightforwardly. So mean density, average density, is 1,440 kilograms per cubic meter. What's the density of water in those same units?
About 1,000.
1,000, right? So the average density of the sun is more dense than water. Pretty weird, right? Note average density though. So the outer layers are not that dense. The inner layers are even more dense. What does the structure look like anyway? Let's see, we have a nice diagram here. There we go. So here is the basic structure of the sun. Inside, this is the interior structure. When we talk about exterior, like atmosphere structure, it's basically all going to be contained inside this line at the top, the black line. Right, so we'll come to that in a second. But the inside of the sun, between the center, zero radius, about the inner third of the sun, is what we call the core. That's where all the nuclear fusion happens. Then the next, between third and, well, the top third, the bottom third, the middle third, I guess, is what we call the radiation zone. And then the top third is what we call the convection zone. So radiation and convection are ways of transporting photons, basically, transporting energy out of the sun. So we'll dig into this more when we talk about how these processes work, obviously not today, but in a couple weeks when we talk about radiation transfer. The basic idea here is that in the top third of the sun, convection is more efficient than radiation, and so that's what powers the ability of the sun to get its photons out, is convection. What's another example of convection from your everyday life? Garrett?
Boiling water.
Right, boiling water. So heating from below, you make material hot, it rises to the top, it cools off, it falls back down. Right, that's what these ovals with arrows are representing. And then in the inner remaining part of the sun, radiation is more efficient, and so things can just, photons can just jump basically from atom to atom, but they don't go very far. The mean free path of a photon inside the sun is just like a fraction of a millimeter, so it doesn't go very far at all. And so it takes like 100,000 years for a photon to go from the core to the surface. It's a long time for a photon to take to get out of the sun. Basic idea here is that temperature is getting hotter as we go from surface to core, right? So temperature starts out cool, you know, 5,700 Kelvin, if you want to call that cold, but it's a million Kelvin or more in the very core here. I actually have a graph of that. two graphs, actually. Oh, come on. Why does it do this to me? There we go. So here is the a graph of temperature and pressure as functions of radius. So it's hot, this is the center, right, and this is the surface out here. Temperature goes as high as 16 million Kelvin here in the very center of the sun and drops off fairly quickly so that the surface is basically 5,000 or so, 6,000. Pressure starts off also very high in units over there of newtons per square meter on the other side, 10 to the 16, which is high, right? It drops off even faster. And then we also have a graph here of, what is this? Density, and then like integrated mass. So as you get further out, you add up more mass, but density also drops off quickly. So the core really is the densest part of the star. Average of 1400 is sort of the very middle part here. Am I reading that right? Oh, no, 10 to the 5. So that'd be way down there. Anyway, this is density versus mass for the interior of the sun. And then, let's see. Okay, let's just quickly talk about the surface too, the outer layers. Yet another diagram here. So here basically this is a diagram showing the surface layers. The actual surface layer, the point that we define as the surface of the sun, is represented by this dashed line here. You can see that it falls inside a region called the photosphere. So photosphere means like photon sphere, where the light comes from. That's the region that we would see if we observe the sun, is the photosphere. That sits, as you can see, the interior part is, so this is sort of the top layer of the, you know, the surface layer, right? It's the top layer of the interior, but it's also the bottom layer of the atmosphere at the same time, because that transition line is in the middle there. How we define what the surface is the point at which the opacity, how thick the sun appears, transitions from opaque to transparent. So it's the point at which the photons no longer need to be transported by convection. They can just radiate away into space. So they just, that's why you can see them, right? They radiate off. David.
So why is it 100 kilometers from the bottom of the photosphere, the surface?
Why is it 100 kilometers from the bottom?
That's going to have mostly to do with these sort of graphs like this on a finer scale, right? So what, we didn't really talk about opacity in the class yet. We will later, but it's dependent on things like temperature and pressure and density and like ionization state of the atoms. And so those conditions all form that perfect combination at that particular depth. So that's why it's there. But the photosphere is thicker because it's sort of there are varying degrees of that throughout that region. But you have to pick one set of values and then pick that one. So on top of the photosphere is the chromosphere, which is a higher temperature region that's hotter than the photosphere. So you sort of reach this this point where you have a temperature of about 6,000 Kelvin, and then above that you get hotter for a while. So chromosphere on top of that, and then there's this sort of thin layer called the transition region, which is just a way to go between chromosphere and something called the corona. The corona looks like, oh, come on. Honestly, why bother? Corona looks like that. This is a picture during a total eclipse, right? That's, who saw the total eclipse a few years ago? So you saw the corona, right? You could, that's the part around it. This is from that eclipse, so that's what it looked like.
That's a real photo.
This is a real photo. Well, it's processed to all hell, but yes, this is a real photo. There's a background star right there. Okay, it's 2 o'clock. We're gonna leave it there. Wednesday, Ray will talk about the AHR diagram, and then on the following Monday, we'll finish up the rest of the sun stuff. But you know what you need to know for AHR diagrams at this point.